this episode of the Sailing Road Podcast, we feature part two of our interview with Neil Hawksford from the Glada Project about building and cruising his Warham 38 catamaran. We also have some sailing news, and our product of the week will keep your boat fenders looking like new. All that and more on the Sailing Road. Welcome to the Sailing Road. If you've ever dreamed of sailing over the horizon, or if you just like to cruise the coast or your local lake, then this podcast is for you. We share the dream to one day sail away full time, and in the meantime, we enjoy our weekend coastal cruising as we build our experience and our cruising funds. My name is Steve Payment, and I am joined by the girl that keeps my sails full all day long, my beautiful fiance, Brandi Bryant.
Hello, everybody.
So we are back for another week here. We did not get out to do any sailing last week. We've got some family things we've been doing the last couple of weeks for Mother's Day. We last weekend went out and saw my mother on the west coast of Florida. And then next weekend, we're going to spend time with Brandy's mom.
Yep.
And we had a great day on the water. My mom loves the water also. So they love beaches. And so we went and visited my mom and my stepfather, and they took us down to a new area that actually we had never been to in Florida.
Yeah, no, never even heard of it.
So area down is called Palm Island Resort. It's south of Venice, Florida. And we had never been anywhere in this area with our boat. We had been north of there and south of there. So it was kind of cool to see it from the Intercoastal Waterway. We weren't on a boat. Well, we took a boat over to
this. A little ferry over.
Yeah, the ferry over to this private island. So Palm Island Resort is a private island, all private homes. So it doesn't have public beach access. So it was kind of cool to go over there. They have some friends that have some property over there. We were able to get on the island and go out on the beach. And it's just a beautiful area of Florida. So I think we're definitely going to get the boat down there at some point.
Different beach than what we're used to, because the beach itself is shelly beach instead of sand beach. So that was a lot of fun to walk through and pick shells and find shark's tooths. And it was cool.
Yeah, the whole
something different. Usually his
covered
parents
with
live
shells.
Usually we are over at Siesta Key, which is where his parents actually live. So we usually go over to the Siesta Key beach and walk around the nice sandy white beach area, but this time we did a little different, so it was nice.
Very relaxing.
Yeah.
So that's about all we've got going on in the what we have for activities right now. One of the things I want to update everyone on is we are going to be updating our Patreon site. We've been kind of lackadaisical about getting things out there and setting it up. We set up some rewards just to kind of test things out, and I wasn't really comfortable with the way I'd set things up, so I'm going to start reworking that. Essentially, what we're going to do is just set up some real simple rewards with Sailing Road merchandise, because I think people would probably like that better. Stickers,
like
hats,
it.
Shirts, and Brandy's been voting for that. So I'm going to work on the logo a little bit, and we'll get some merchandise worked up. And I just didn't one of the first reward was to get extra content, and it was just kind of a pain to do the extra content and set that up, and I'd rather just put everything out here
on the show. We think everybody should hear all of it.
So we want everybody to hear all of that. So we're going to get that redesigned, and then we also added, if you prefer, some people don't care to do the Patreon for the subscription, we've set up a one-time donation. So if you like a show and you want to make a one-time donation, you want to give us a tip for something you really liked in the show, you can do that through the Sailing Road website. We're going to have a link there to do that. So, I think that is it for the news.
The only thing we have going on is our cruise in 2 weeks, huh?
Yep. So we got some vacation coming up, and we'll probably be delayed a little bit in the podcast for about a week while we're off on vacation. But I think we'll just move right into the interview. So the part two of the interview that we did with Neil Hawksford is what we're featuring this week. And this part of the interview, I talked with Neil a little bit more about his preparation of the boat to go cruising, and then where they've cruised so far and some of their plans, where they plan to cruise next. So here is the interview.
Boy, I don't even think I've ever looked at a Warham up close, but I was looking at your pictures and curious about when you are sailing. So the Warhams, the way they're set up is you have the cross beams are essentially tied to the boat through lashings.
There are people going, what?
Okay. So, which, I mean, the ancient, Pacific canoes have been doing for, you know, thousands of years. So it's, I'm sure that, you know, it's seaworthy. But I was curious, do you feel the movement between the hulls? Because there has to be some flexibility in there, right? That it moves a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And that you've hit on a key point of the Warham designs. I mean, firstly, you know, anybody that knows anything about Warham, well, you can Google them and find out. But in a nutshell, Warham designs are basically Polynesian canoes. They're based on a Polynesian design. So you touched on that earlier. Yeah, they're basically two canoes lashed together with a deck between them.
Right.
And well, he does everything from an 18-foot beach cat up to a 63-foot expedition boat, and they're all basically the same design, scaled up or down. So yeah, you're right. The beams sit in troughs. On this boat, the bigger boats, it actually has an 18mm stainless pin through the centre of the beam and the trough. But then inboard and outboard of that trough, you have lashings which hold the beam in place. So there is a very slight movement between the hulls and the beams. And in fact, nothing on a Warham is solidly fixed. The beams are dropped into the troughs and lashed to the hulls. And then the centre steering pod, the decks, the mast beam, the aft deck, the ramp, everything else basically sits in and on the beams. So, you know, in most cases, held by rope if necessary. So it could sound as if the whole boat moves around, but these lashings are so tight. The only time I've experienced any movement at all was actually as we came the last leg across Biscay, as we were coming into La Coruña, early hours in the morning. We had quite a nasty cross swell coming in at us. It was blowing about, well, high 20 knots, and there was a cross swell, and I could actually just pick up a very slight movement between the hulls and the aft beam. But you know, that's a good thing, because the point of that is to take away a huge amount of stress. The problem with a lot of bridge deck catamarans, where everything is fixed rigidly and all the accommodation, the bulk of the accommodation is between the hulls, is that they have to build the things hugely strong to take the stresses involved. Whereas just having that little bit of flexibility, it's a bit like a tree trunk, right. Tree swaying in the breeze. It takes an awful lot of that away.
Interesting. Yeah, I was just curious how much if you felt it move, or if it was like independent suspension in a car that it moved a lot, you know, with the waves. No, but it sounds like it's fairly stiff.
In extreme situations, you might just feel it slightly, but no, in effect, it's negligible, and you wouldn't even notice it most of the time.
Right. And then, I mean, as you're cruising under sail, so it has two masts, and then you can also run a jib, right?
Yeah.
So does it... How does it point into the wind?
It's pretty good, actually. I mean, the rig is, again, unique to Warham. She's actually a wing sail schooner. So we have the two sails are basically gaff rigged, soft footed, and they're quite unusual, but they work very, very well. Pointing into the wind, I try and avoid doing it.
Absolutely. Just go where the wind's going.
That's, we're not on a timetable. So
that's why you picked this lifestyle, not to have to be anywhere.
Absolutely. But when push comes to shove,
right.
Yeah, you can probably get to about 50 degrees.
Okay.
But here's the thing. It's a bit crazy to try and do that, because unlike a monohull where you're kind of constantly pinching and constantly trying to get, you know, the best that you can, with a cat, if you actually come off the wind a little bit, the acceleration is phenomenal.
Right.
It kind of makes it pointless trying to beat up too much, because
just go faster and
if you come off the wind a bit, she picks up her heels and flies, and you'll make up the ground far quicker than you will ever trying to beat tighter into it.
Makes sense. Yeah, I'd forgot about in looking at the pictures. I just somewhere in my mind captured when I saw the sails that they were loose footed. That you know, most gaff, you know, you see traditional gaff rigs, they have a boom and then the gaff up top. And is that just for help for overall sail shape?
Yeah. And as I say, they're a wing sail. So basically it's zipped around the mast.
Okay.
So it's sleeved over the mast. So it gives a better aerofoil shape around the mast. So you don't need that boom.
Good. And what's your typical kind of cruising speed, you know, in the normal winds?
You should, I mean, without any drama, you'll be into high single figures, on a reach, and bear in mind, construction plans say this boat should weigh about 3.5 tons without cruising gear on board. I think you probably add another ton to that, at least, I should think. But, if you're on a reach, you'll easily hit 10, 12 knots without really trying. There's no drama involved in that.
Right.
Coming through the Ras de Seine around Brittany, where we did have, to be fair, we did have a bit of tide underneath us, but we were on a reach there, and we saw 17.5 knots.
Wow.
Which was fun. For a couple of hours we shot round that corner, but again, it was fun and there was no real drama. I think there's a lot of monohull sailors who see pictures of racing cats and fear of capsize and flying along with one hull in the air,
right?
That's certainly not the case. I mean, there's no record of a Warham catamaran ever capsizing. Frankly, she's under rigged.
Right.
The whole design and the rig means that I just don't see any way that you would ever be able to capsize one of these boats. The biggest danger actually with a cat is going too fast in a big sea and actually pitch poling, burying the bow. But again, that's down to design, and that only ever happens to racing cats that are just pushing too hard, frankly.
Well, if the Warhams have this design on the traditional Polynesian canoes, that those were optimized for a little bit of surfing too, aren't they?
They really
surf in the swells, so that gives you a little bit extra speed when you're in the swells.
Yeah. But we have a drogue, which is there to be used if necessary, but I really, really hope I never have to try it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about where you've cruised so far. So you launched the boat in England, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Up on in the River Tamar, which is the border between Devon and Cornwall, runs inland from Plymouth, the famous seaport.
Oh, okay. And that was 3 years ago?
No, we go to that now.
Okay. So where have you gone since then?
Well, we just, I wildly underestimated Actually, I wildly underestimated a lot of the build, but another part of the build that I did wildly underestimate was how long it would take to actually get her rigged and sailing. Again, you tend to focus on the big things like getting the boat to the coast and then getting the boat assembled and getting the boat in the water. And then once I'd got her in the water, of course, stepping the masts and sorting out little things like running rigging and standing rigging.
Right.
when you've just got to, again, don't build a boat, buy a boat and get it. Anyway, we got her on the water in May 2 years ago, and it took until nearly the end of July before we were actually able to sail her properly. So we took things very steadily. We just cruised the southwest coast of the UK from Plymouth down to Foy and Falmouth and back again.
And that's some of the same route that you did in the book, correct?
I had to keep
bringing up maps because of course I know nothing about the geography of the UK, I was doing Google Earth following you into these little every time you said you anchored somewhere.
I have to say, the southwest of the UK is an incredible cruising area,
and Falmouth
in particular, where I spent a lot of time, is just beautiful. It's sad they only get summer for 4 weeks of the year, but apart from that, it is beautiful. And so anyway, we did that, and I actually had intended that we would get the boat to Portugal that first winter, and I was working on that right up until really the November, but we just ran out of time. The weather that year was crap. We just couldn't get a weather window, and time was pushing on. I had a young lad who was going to crew for me, and he lived in the Channel Islands, so there was logistics involved in getting him ready and over, and it was getting very, very stressful. And we got to late October, early November, and although I've crossed Biscay in December once, and it is all about weather window at the same time, being sensible about it, that, you know what, you know, it's too late now. So we were kind of forced to spend a winter in Falmouth, which on board this boat wasn't a great deal of fun. You know, I'll tell you all about cold and condensation. We know a lot about that now, but we got
you don't that. You haven't installed like a diesel or wood stove in the boat.
No, it can be done. And I mean, let's be honest, if I intended to live aboard in the UK, I would not have built a Warham catamaran. It's because don't forget, you're also living in two boats. You know, we have the sleeping.
Oh, that's true. You can't heat both sides at the same time. You need two stoves.
We have a separate steering pod in the center of the boat, but basically to go between the head, the sleeping compartment, the galley saloon is crossing the deck. In fact, I heard a great story. Somebody who'd been moored next to a Warham catamaran. And I don't know, have you heard of these little creatures called meerkats?
Yeah.
They come out, I think there's like desert rats or something, and they come out of little holes.
We have prairie dogs in the United States. They're very similar.
That kind of thing. Well, basically, they got nicknamed the meerkats because from this monohull, all they ever saw was somebody popping up out of one hatch, shooting across the deck and disappearing down another hatch. You know,
I had forgot that. I meant to ask you about that because that was the other thing before I looked at your build. And it still wasn't clear because we were talking about it. You're gonna do a video of the finished boat, but I could hear from your description. You're like, well, there's stairs here, and then there's stairs here, and then I saw another. There's a recent cat build, 58 foot Akai or something like that, and I could see that the bathroom, the head had it was like separate from all the living quarters, and you had to go outside to get back down into it. So I was Now it makes more sense.
It's a warm climate boat. So that first winter in Falmouth was not fun. But anyway, in hindsight, it was the right thing to do, and in fact, gave me a bit longer to prep the boat. So in May of last year, we were finally ready to go. So as I mentioned, I had a young lad who had offered to crew for me. He was on the Channel Islands, island of Alderney in the Channel Islands, over by France there. So we went across cross channel to Alderney. We had a beautiful couple of weeks in Alderney and picked up Jake, the crew. And then Jake stayed with us. We came down from Alderney around the around Ushant, around Brittany, around to the south of Brittany, had a couple of stops around there. And then we had a three-day crossing of Biscay to A Coruña, northern Spain. Spent a glorious week.
Oh, I just lost you. You there, Neil?
Went again, didn't it?
Yeah, it's perfect. It's so perfect, and then all of a sudden, it's just dead. Nothing. Normally, the other times you hear people, their voices start, you know, kind of going out, but not here. It's like perfectly clear, and then you're gone.
So where did I get to?
You had crossed the Biscay, and then you said somewhere else, and then I think you were gone. Biscay, so just go back to crossing the Biscay.
Yeah, so we had 3 days across the Bay of Biscay. Fantastic voyage that was. I mean, Biscay can be hell, but it can be heaven. And it was our first proper ocean crossing, if you like, for 3 days.
Was that the first time you tried to cross the Biscay since the last adventure that's in the book?
Yes.
That had to be a little nerve-wracking.
Not nerve-wracking because, you know, completely different circumstances. I knew I knew the boat was right. I knew the weather was right. I knew I was right. Anybody.
And you had other people to help with not having to deal with tiredness.
Yeah, I mean, crew. I mean, it's perhaps worth mentioning here about Gail, my partner, because Gail's sailing experience until she got on this boat was zero. She hadn't even camped in her life.
Wow.
She didn't do outdoors at all. Gail and I got together when I was about a year into building this boat. And once it was obvious that things were going good and it was getting serious, we had to have a sit down. And I said to Gail, look, before we go too far here, you need to understand something. I'm building this boat and I'm going sailing. I can't tell you when. It's going to be some years away, but it's going to happen. And I'm going to have to do it, you know.
Right.
You need to understand I've got to do this. She said, fine, great, you know, no problem. But she would admit that, you know, then, as I said, we were talking years down the track. So she pretty much put it on the back burner and said, well, we'll deal with it when and if it happens. I think, as did a lot of people when they came to see these bits of plywood sitting in a farmyard barn and me saying I was going to be sailing away in them. they wondered if it was ever going to happen.
Right.
Hell, there were occasions where I wondered if it was. But that was the situation. So when I mentioned that we sailed from Falmouth to the Channel Islands, that was Gail's first proper sail. We'd only done day sails along the coast up until that point. And I kind of misled Gail. I made a miscalculation with my navigation because I figured we could do it in 12 hours. Unfortunately, it took 26.
Wow, that's a little bit of a miscalc.
I kind of knew that, but I didn't want Gail to know that.
True. Don't want the first big sail passage, you don't want him to know it's going to be that long.
But at the same time, I'd said to her, look, you know, I could handle the boat myself. So, you know, you just go to bed. You know, if you need to, you can go to bed. So that's the start. What I was leading to was that for her to come across Biscay, you know, the reason I wanted Jake, the crew on board, was I was able to say to Gail, I dearly want you to come. I dearly want you to experience this. But you don't need to feel that you need to be responsible for anything, that you need to do anything. You know, if you need to spend the whole time in your bed, you can, you know. But right. I want you to experience it. So she was very, very understandably wary and probably a little bit scared, you know.
Sure.
But to her credit, she was up for it. And, you know, we had a beautiful crossing. And you know, a highlight I remember, second night out, we're creaming along at about 5-6 knots in a beautiful breeze, clear sky, perfect conditions. About 3 o'clock in the morning, and we had a pod of dolphins arrive. You may have seen this yourself, I don't know, but dolphins at night mixed with phosphorescence in the water.
Oh yeah, I've heard about it. I have not saw it.
Wow. You know, it's like phosphorescent torpedoes coming in at 90 degrees to the bow and then flashing. Wow. And I basically went down below and dragged Gail out of her bed, still half asleep. You've got to come up on deck and see this. And she didn't understand why. She didn't know why. She didn't want to. And, you know, the minute I dragged her up on the bow and said, look, you know, that's a moment we'll never forget. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, that, you know, that was incredible. So anyway, we got across Biscay. We arrived in A Coruña in northern Spain. We had a week there. We cruised around the corner down towards Cape Finisterre. Jake, unfortunately, had to leave us then and head back home. So from that point on, it was just Gail and I. And we spent the entire summer working our way down through the Rias of northern Spain, exploring them. Beautiful part of the world, apart from the fog, which we had a few issues with. But then down to Portugal, to Porto, to Lisbon, and then eventually down round the corner, around the magical Cape St. Vincent, and round here to the Algarve.
So I had somebody ask me recently, we talked to a lot of cruisers about their adventures, and they'd asked about checking in to foreign countries. You know, you hear all these different bureaucracies, especially people going down through the islands, it changes everywhere. How is it in the EU, if you're part of Europe, is it easy to check into Spain or Portugal, or is it still a process?
No, I'm aware. We have it very easy at the moment. While the UK still is part of the EU, obviously they're having a referendum on that in a few months' time, and that could change a lot of things. But at the moment, the free passage of EU members makes it very, very easy for us. I mean, it is so informal. You know, normally the marinas handle the paperwork. They take a photocopy of your passports and the ship documentation. We've had one visit from customs who were very pleasant and just came on board and checked a few things. But for us as European citizens in the EU at the moment, it's very, very easy. But I'm very aware that, you know, it can change. It does change. It will change when we go further afield. We've had some very good friends that we met up with from the States, from your side of the water. You know, they got caught out in Portugal with it and had to pay a fairly hefty fine. And in fact, they've had to head back out of the EU for a period of months because they're not allowed to stay all the time.
So, oh, the part of the VAT and all of that.
Yeah, Schengen Agreement, as it's called in the EU. Okay. Yeah, so it's complicated. And I know, you know, when we go further afield, and I guess for us coming to your side of the pond, you know, we would have bigger issues. So all you can do is keep up to date. And I mean, there are some, again, the internet makes it easy. There are sites that give you the latest information. Noon site, of course, is a big one.
Right.
But just talk to people, you know, wherever you are, you're talking to people who've been where you're going 9 times out of 10, and you'll always find out what the latest situation is.
So if you're in the EU right now, when you go to Spain or Portugal, it's just paperwork. There's no fees for you to go into any of these places?
No.
Oh, wow.
All.
Okay, that's great.
I mean, it's free movement and yeah, in effect. I mean, we're kind of a little bit outside the law here, you know. I don't mean that in the legal sense. What I mean is we're in a kind of grey area on a boat, you know, because we're always moving. You know, it's very difficult, even with, you know, with residency and tax and all the rest of it. It's I think all of us full-time cruisers have the same sort of experience, you know, that there are people who, you know, they've got driving licenses and tax information, and they're on paper, they're registered citizens of a country, but most of them are not spending any time there at all, you know.
Right.
And the system can't really deal with us living the lifestyle we're living, so you just have to kind of work around it as best you can. It's not a case of trying to avoid the law or avoid issues. You just do the common sense thing, and you know. Yeah.
So yeah. Even from a time limit, any of the countries say that you can only spend so much time here, or we're going to consider you a resident, and that's a whole different thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think Spain, they've got something like 170 days or something, and then you have to kind of fill in another form, you know.
Right.
But it's all very, very easy, frankly. Mm. And within the EU at the moment, if you're in an EU country and you're an EU citizen, it's pretty damn easy.
Right. So what's your future cruising plans? Where are you going from here?
Well, we're going to have a very easy, relaxed summer this summer. I think, you know, I'm still kind of getting used to this. And everything's been so intense, you know, getting the boat on the water. As I've said, you know, our previous year was kind of getting ready to go and then not being able to go. And then last year, although we took it easy, you know, we had some big things to do. We had crew and crossing Biscay and all the rest of it, and just getting used to sailing the boat. So it was all fairly intense in some respects. So this year we're going to take it really easy. We're going to go between here, where we are now, just around the corner of Portugal. We're going to take a very slow cruise all the way down to Gibraltar. I say all the way down, it's all of about 300 miles, but there's some beautiful rivers to explore. There's a river called the Guadiana, which is actually the border between Portugal and Spain. You can go up there probably 20 miles inland and anchor and explore almost inland. There's also a big river that goes up to the Spanish city of Seville. That goes about 30 or 40 miles inland. So there's some beautiful places to explore, and with my boat being shallow draft and able to take the ground, we can actually explore some areas that the bigger boats can't. So yeah, we may end up spending more time away from the sea in some respects, up rivers this year, than actually cruising. But yeah, so we'll do that. We'll take as much time as we want. We'll get down to Gibraltar. We're provisionally looking at wintering in the Mediterranean next year. We're going to go around the corner and up the Murcian coast of Spain, the Mediterranean coast of Spain, to a place called Cartagena, not the one in Colombia, the one
right
in Spain, and maybe winter there. But all cruisers know, you have ideas and you have thoughts, but you're wary of using the word plans, because they'll change.
Absolutely.
They will change. Well, that's strange. Yeah, that's you calling me on my iPad. I don't know how that's working.
Strange. Who knows what Skype's doing?
So, yeah. That's
If you think about your future of, hey, I've always dreamed of doing this. Do you have thoughts of someday I'd like to cross the Atlantic?
Absolutely.
Like
no,
okay.
More than that. I mean, my ultimate long-term, and I suppose it comes back to building this Warham catamaran, and given what we've talked about her origins, my long-term is Pacific, Polynesian Islands and New Zealand.
Oh, that'd be interesting. Yeah, go back to its origins.
But that's years down the track, you know.
Sure.
But yeah, I think, you know, Gail wants to see the Greek islands, so I can see her spending a couple of years in the Med.
Right.
I think by then, you know, we'll be ready for a bit to go a bit further. So I suspect after that, yeah, we'll be looking at an Atlantic crossing. The West Indies.
Well, it sounds like from the cruising you can do around Spain there and then even into the Med, are there any really long passages, or are you even doing overnights, or is most of it something you can a full day, you know, just skip to marina to marina? Or
no, it'd be day sailing pretty much where we are. I mean, there are people that you can go out to the Azores, you can go out to Madeira, you can go to the Canaries, but it's, you know, that's a sort of 3-4-5 day passage from here,
right?
But then it's quite hard to get back, you know. That's kind of, people save that for when they're going to go across the Atlantic, but
right.
Quite a few people go out to Madeira from here and come back, because that's a couple of days.
So it sounds like a good way to build up your experience as you think about those futures.
And I have to say, this part of the world, you know, we've met this winter here in this marina, we've met a lot of people who've cruised the world, literally. You know, they've cruised the world and they've come back here. And an awful lot of people have said, you know, of all the places we've been, for the lifestyle, for the cost of living, for the climate, this part of the world has got a lot going for it, I have to say.
Fantastic. Well, that's one of the reasons I love to talk to different cruisers around the world and get their experience, because we talk to so many people, and out of the United States, so much is concentrated either from the Bahamas down through the Caribbean, or next over is kind of Mexico and a little bit of South America, but then people just head through the Panama Canal and do the whole Pacific over to Australia and New Zealand. But you don't hear a lot about, you know, cruising in these other areas, Spain. That's one of the things I really enjoyed reading your book and kind of visualizing, pulling into these little anchorages, and you walk on shore and suddenly you're in a, you know, historical town, which, you know,
absolutely,
compared to the United States has, you know, thousands of years of history. It's just really interesting. So I think it would be fun cruise in those.
No, absolutely. I mean, Cartagena that I mentioned in Spain that we're hoping to winter in next winter. I mean, as I understand it, there's a Roman amphitheater half a mile from the marina, you know.
Wow.
In the middle of the town. So I mean, Spain and Portugal particularly has a lot of Roman relics. But you know what, it's just a point I think worth making, and again it comes back to me building this type of boat, having a simple boat, having a boat that can take the ground, having a boat that I'm really happy to anchor with. This is, you know, we've spent the winter in a marina. I have to say, probably because Gail wanted some comfort more than me, I'd have been quite happy on the hook in a few places, you know. But
right.
But the point is, for our cruising, I try and avoid marinas, you know, because A, they're not particularly nice places to be most of the time. They're very expensive, particularly in the summer and particularly for a catamaran. With this boat, we can go into places. There's a little place around the corner here called Alvor, which is a little fishing village. It's actually quite difficult to get into because even at high water spring tides, you may only have a couple of meters of water. So the monohulls are very wary of it. We can get in and out of there, no problem. We can dry out if we need to. In fact, when we come out of here next week, I'm not paying haulage to get my boat hauled out and antifouled, cleaned off and antifouled. I'm going to go around to Alvor and we're going to dry her out on a sandbank, and I shall do it there. So that's what we're doing. And so I want to spend time actually on, you know, exploring places where a lot of other people don't go, getting off the beaten track, you know, living cheaply and enjoying these places, really exploring and traveling rather than just cruising from marina to marina and plugging in when you get there.
Right. Well, that's another area that I wanted to talk about is, you know, everybody's always wondering, well, how are you going to fund this? And you talked about that a little bit earlier. At some point you just said, I've just got to make the decision and go. But now that you've been doing it for, you know, getting going in this last year of cruising, how do you see yourself being able to fund this and then also have the costs been in line with what you see you can do long term?
I mean, firstly, I mean, the complete honesty here, I am funding this at the moment because I've pulled some money out of my pension pot. I haven't pulled an enormous amount of money out of my pension pot, but that was how I was going to do it initially, just to get us started. Right. As I've discovered with writing the book, I'm not saying it's a bestseller by any stretch of the imagination, but you know what? It's putting some money in the bank every month.
Sure.
And it's a rinse and repeat process. So I think for me, that's definitely one option. But I think the biggest thing is a recalibration. I think when a lot of people think about, I want to go cruising, you know, if you try and work out the costs, depending on who you speak to, you're going to get wildly different figures. But I think, you know, if you want to, I'm not sure what I'm trying to say here. People have different ideas of what's needed. I think what, and Gail is probably a better bellwether for this than I am, because I kind of already knew it. She has been staggered how cheaply we can live. Right. and live comfortably. Now, obviously, that depends where you are, and the cost of living in Spain and Portugal is probably one of the lowest in Europe as a whole. But just, you know, food and wine is so cheap, it's ridiculous. You know, we don't eat out regularly, and if we do, we try and find a little local taverna type place, you know, that costs a few euros. It's almost no more than it would be if we went and bought the stuff at the supermarket. So we don't live extravagantly, and yeah, it would be nice to have a little bit more. But, you know, we managed to save up enough money to pay for the marina, but we spent 6 weeks on the anchor before we came here. It cost nothing, you know, it was free to anchor just off the town.
Right.
You know, so basically we were buying food and drink. And if I tell you that cost us a little over 200 euros, which probably is about $200, actually, it's not much different, you know,
right.
for the month.
Yeah. And I think it back to what you said, and Gail is realizing of what you thought you needed when you started. And then you realize, well, I'm enjoying the lifestyle so much and just relaxing on the boat and just getting to know a town. And that becomes my entertainment rather than all the things I thought I would need as entertainment or all the things, all the stuff I thought I would need in my life.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm not preaching. I don't want to preach about this. It's up to individuals to make their own decisions on this. But I just think a lot of people get lulled into thinking that they need far, far more than they actually do. And it's a hard thing to get your head around. And it's a difficult thing to put, as I say, to go out there and say, you know, you kind of think, I've got to have X thousand in the bank before I can even think about doing this, you know?
Right.
And that ends up being a brick wall. That ends, you know, they never get that money, or they never feel they have the necessary comfort value. I mean, we have no property. You know, there are plenty of people cruising that have a property somewhere, and they've got the rental off of that that keeps it coming in. There's many, many different ways of getting a little bit of money coming into the account every month. But if you adapt your lifestyle, you know, bring the costs down, and it's easy to do without even feeling any pain at all. You know, we eat and drink comfortably. We have lots of friends. And there's another thing, you know, a lot of this stuff is free. You know, we've made so many friends doing this, far, far more than we would ever have done sit back in a house in the UK. And these are probably friends for life that we'll keep in touch with, you know. It's just a whole lifestyle thing. And I think, you know, what have you got to lose at the end of the day if you take the plunge? Find a way to get out there and try it and see what works for you, see what it does actually cost you and what you can do and what you can't do. Give it a go, because what's the worst that can happen? You know, it doesn't work out and you have to pack it up and go back to what you were doing before, you know.
Absolutely. So a few other things in the kind of the financial area. Do you have the boat insured, or is that required by a number of the marinas?
It's third parties. I mean, I can't get the boat comprehensively insured because she's home.
Right.
She's home built. Here's an interesting thing: this boat is actually legally worthless, because in the EU they have a wonderful regulation that unless you build to strict standards and pay handsomely to have the boat inspected at various periods during the build, in effect it doesn't have a certificate. So. You can't actually sell the boat for 5 years after she's launched. So strictly speaking, the boat is worthless in the EU.
Wow.
It's kind of academic to me. But the answer to your question is no. Third party insurance certainly marinas demand it, and most countries will ask for proof of insurance. It's a sensible thing to do. If you come in a marina and clatter somebody sure. else's expensive boat, you know, it could lead to all sorts of issues. So yeah, but that cost me less than $150 a year, and that covers all of the Mediterranean, you know, for my third party right. insurance. So that's
and then health insurance, you guys are covered by the UK or?
Well, again, within the EU, there's reciprocal agreements between countries in the EU. So, of course, in the UK, we have our wonderful National Health Service, and we can get health cover okay. within the EU for free. The standards vary enormously. Being sensible about it when we go further afield, it's probably something I'll have to look at. At the moment, it's not right. a concern.
Well, great. Well, I think that covers most of the areas. I guess the one area we haven't really got into is any kind of problems or close calls or issues you've had in passages so far that, you know, you've had to deal with. People always like to hear stories of, you know, some difficulty in how you got through.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think, you know, without trying to hype the book, I've had enough difficulties and trials to get through that I wrote about in A Foolish yeah. Voyage. That,
well, and definitely, I think we're going to point people to those.
I mean,
to those adventures, boat, but the current boat.
I mean, yeah, no, I mean on this boat, no, we've had a few minor mishaps, but I've actually been really pleased with the way the boat has performed out the box, as it were. You know, we've been in some, I mean. When you're cruising in the way that we're cruising with no timetable in this part of the world, there's not much excuse now with the weather forecasting for getting it wrong. You know, people push the luck a bit and get caught out. But again, this is something I learned on deliveries. You know, 9 times out of 10, it's because they've got to be somewhere at a certain time. And so they push things. We're lucky enough that we haven't got that. And with the accuracy of weather forecasts now, certainly coastally, you know, we've had no issues at all. And I don't really anticipate having any. When we get into the Med, you can get caught out with squalls and things and localized winds. But, you know, you can be prepared for that. So, and again, modern navigation aids make life so much easier, don't they, for all of us. I mean, I didn't have that benefit when I was sailing 30 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you know, I think
keeps
we
you out of a lot of trouble.
Yeah, you know, the fact that you can, we actually, I wouldn't advise this to anybody, but I touched on the fact that one of the things northern Spain is known for is fog. And we had a couple of days where we're sailing along in glorious sunshine 1 minute, and then we see this bank of fog and it just comes down. That's probably our hairiest time because we have no radar. We have AIS, not a transponder. We can receive AIS, but obviously that's only the big boys that you can see. So, you know, using your eyes and your ears as much as you can. But we actually had to do 2 port approaches in near zero visibility, relying entirely on the plotter. Now,
right.
that I wouldn't recommend that to anybody, and there's risk involved with it. But equally, it was a balance because the alternative was to stay offshore in the fog that we didn't know was going to clear or not, with fishing boats and other vessels around, with a deteriorating weather forecast, or to rely on the plotter and take it very steady and head in.
Right.
And I have to say, you know, on both occasions, the plotter was absolutely spot on. You know, the first time we saw the moles of the harbour entrance were when we were exactly midway between the two of them, you know.
Oh, wow.
That was a bit heart in mouth. And as I say, I wouldn't recommend it. But yeah, you know, that again shows how, you know, the gadgetry that we've got now used sensibly is an absolute godsend.
Right. And back to I was just thinking, so when you first launched the boat, you know, I think that people look at a lot of these, you know, homemade wooden boats, essentially plywood covered with epoxy and you know, put all together with epoxy, and people wonder about the quality and yeah. and also the maintenance and the upkeep. When you first put the boat in the water, did it have any leaks?
No.
Not a single leak.
Of course not.
Great.
How could there be? I mean, there's another thing, you know. Most boats leak through hull fittings, don't they? You know, or
true.
Damage, you know. We have, and let me get this right, we've actually got, I've actually only got one hull fitting below the waterline, and that, okay. that's a saltwater inlet for the galley sink. We have a composting toilet, so I have no right. no outlets there either. But no, I mean, I knew there's no way, you know, the hull, it's 9mm ply sheathed with 4mm fiberglass cloth, sheathed and covered in about four layers of epoxy resin, and then right. several more layers of paint. You know, there's just yeah. there's no way.
There's no way water is going to get through. Yeah.
The bilges are
and the upkeep so far, you haven't had any issues with water getting into the wood layer because it's all
can't do it. I mean, good at this point. I mean, again, going back to basics, you know, I use top quality marine plywood to build the hulls,
right.
And not only did I make sure it was stamped correctly, which you'll see a lot of marine plywood stamped correctly that isn't marine plywood. So don't just assume because the vendor tells you it's marine and because it's got a stamp on it, it is. I actually boil tested samples of all of the ply that I used. So firstly, even if water got into the ply, it's still not going to disintegrate overnight. So no, I mean, you know, there's no issues at all. In fact, the bilges in this boat, some of the bilges have still got dust in from when the boat was built.
Fantastic. Well, great. Well, it sounds like it's good quality build and it's going to bring you a lot of enjoyment for years to come.
Absolutely.
So it's been great talking to you. I was really looking forward to this one. It's so funny. I know I will never build a big boat. My brother builds small boats and he's kind of got me into it. And I've thought about building a little sailing canoe or something along those lines, and I'll eventually get there and do that because it's on my bucket list to do. And I just have a lot of respect for builders that take on these big projects, because if you look back, that's 8 years of nights and weekends, and just there's so many details. We stand on our boat, a production fiberglass boat, and I look at it and I think of all the things they had to think about as they designed it, as they put it together, the rigging, and it's just overwhelming. And I know it's a matter of taking it one day at a time and one step at a time, but it's still to think 8 years of time and effort to go into that. It's a great accomplishment.
Well, I appreciate that, Steve, but you know what? I think there's an important point to make here. And it's perhaps a good sign off, you know, I kind of started building a boat, but ultimately the reason I kept going and the reason I finished was because I was actually building a new life. That sounds corny, but for me, that was it. This boat wasn't just a boat. It was a means for me to completely change my lifestyle and get where I wanted to be. And that was my motivation. I think, you know, if you want to build a boat and get some satisfaction from it, yeah, build a canoe, build a little dinghy. You'll get just as much fun and just as much satisfaction from doing that. I think, you know, to build a boat like this one, you've got to want something a lot more than just building a boat.
Right. No, that's a great point. Well, I really appreciate the time, and I wish you and Gail the best. Hopefully, at some point in the future, if we either you sail this way or we sail that way, we'll pull up in an anchorage together and have a great chat and get caught up.
Absolutely, and thanks so much for inviting me onto this podcast. It's a first for me, and I'm really grateful that you've asked me on, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And the best to both of you and your sailing. And let's hope we can hook up somewhere and enjoy a sundowner on the anchor together.
Absolutely. Great. Thanks, Neil. Have a great day.
All the very best. Bye-bye.
Well, I want to thank Neil again for coming on the show and doing the interview. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this one.
You did a good job without me, babe.
It was hard. You definitely...
It was hard, but it was a lot of fun hearing you guys just chat about things. It was a good flow.
It's more fun to have you along because you put in some color commentary. And
I pipe in, is what you're saying.
The female perspective comes in and asks things that I don't think of or things I forget about. So it's still, I'd rather have you on board when we're doing the interviews, but it was still fun. And it's fun to hear the excitement in Neil's voice after all that hard work and putting the boat together and finally getting out cruising and some of their future plans. You can just tell that they're so excited about where they're going to go next.
He sounds like one of those guys that you could just sit down in the cockpit and sit for hours on end with just stories and talking and chatting. So really
absolutely.
Nice guy.
Yeah, absolutely. So definitely keep up with them on theGladaProject.com, their blog, And if you, I think it's also be good if you go on their blog or you can go directly to the site. Gail also has a blog that she's keeping up. So you can get the perspective, a female perspective, and also perspective of somebody that hasn't really done a lot of sailing or cruising as she starts this adventure along with Neil, and just get her take on the different passages they make and the different places they go. And her blog is Land Girl Afloat. So it's landgirlafloat.com. And I'll put all those links in the show notes on the website. And also, don't forget to pick up a copy of Neil's book, A Foolish Voyage. It is just a really fun read. I really enjoyed it. One of my favorite books this year I've read on sailing. So highly recommend it. It's going to be in our Amazon store. And I'll also put the link here in the show notes. You can just go right from your phone to the show notes, click right on it. It'll take you in there. And it's a simple buy. And I know you'll really enjoy it.
So I'm guessing he didn't talk you into wanting to build a boat?
No, okay. I'm not building a boat. I would rather buy the boat because I want to enjoy the boat. I don't think I would enjoy the process of building the boat. I think I would enjoy paying somebody else to build me a boat.
There you go.
That's an idea. And just watch them do it.
Put in the process. Put your 2 cents
in. Yeah, while I go make money and do something else. But I more power to them. I think it's really an awesome thing when somebody's able to
it's
do that.
It's definitely a patient person.
Right. So up next is the sailing news. We'll be right back. Okay, now we're going to cover the sailing news. I've pulled together a couple of cool stories this week. And the first one's more of an announcement. So the ARC Rally organizers have set up a pretty cool event that's coming up the weekend of May 14th and 15th in the UK. It's located in Berthington Boatyard in Lymington, UK. And essentially what it is it's a blue water seminar weekend. It's totally free. You do have to pre-register, and I'll put all this in the show notes so you can figure out where to pre-register. But I thought the cool thing about this event, it's all about blue water cruising. And they're doing it at this yacht brokerage called Berthington International. And then they're going to have all kinds of cruisers there with their boats. So you can tour through all kinds of different cruisers' boats and see how they've set it up, how they've rigged it, their sails, all their boating equipment, you know, chat with the cruisers that are out there doing it right now. So it's just a really good opportunity, totally free, to get out there and talk with some cruisers, see their boats, kind of see how they're all set up. And then they have a whole program of seminars about, you know, different aspects of, you know, what, how to get sail training for cruising, how to buy the right blue water boat, refitting for blue water, sails and rigging, all kinds of different things. So just thought I would put it out there. If you're interested, the weekend of May 14th and 15th in Lymington, UK. And our next story I found is from an article in Cruising World. One of the writers was talking about U.S. Sailing's leadership forum that he attended in February in San Diego. And, you know, he's looking at all these different sessions they had, and one caught his eye that he went to called Improving Offshore Safety with the Right Gear. And the speaker was a guy named Chuck Hawley, who is the U.S. Sailing Safety at Sea Chairman. And he's talking about essentially the essentials of what you should have when you're going offshore for safety. And one of the first things he recommended is attending a safety at sea seminar. I think U.S. Sailing does these seminars. But they talk about at the sessions, they teach you how search and rescue operations work, which is good to know, you know, how the process goes if something does go wrong, how are all these things being coordinated and the safety ships coming after you. And then they also talk about how to prepare to abandon ship, how to
grab
administer
all your bathing suits.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's what Brandy would do. Grab all the bathing suits. That's the one thing that you would throw in the ditch bag.
Gotta be prepared.
Never have too Options. Many bathing suits when you're stuck on a deserted island with your help sign on the beach, but you're gonna have
it lots look good when they come to pick you up.
Lots
right?
of fashionable bathing suits.
Sorry.
So they also talk about these safety at sea seminars. They teach you how to administer first aid. Talk about effective jury rig repairs you can do to get the boat and the crew home in one piece. And then they go through a list of key items that you should have if you're going offshore for safety. And a lot of these just make common sense, but I think they made a lot of good points in the article that I highlighted, because I think about as we prepare equipment like that when we get a cruising boat and go offshore. Number one is always a good inflatable PFD, or they should just say a PFD of some sort. Some people don't like the inflatable ones. And a tether is the top of the list. And, you know, be sure to inflate and test your PFD annually, and especially before heading out on a long passage. And they also said to bring along spare inflator cartridges, which I know my inflatable PFD went off once just getting wet in the boat. So, if you're going on a long passage and the first 2 days you get splashed or something and the thing goes off, it's good to be able to recharge it. So I think that makes sense to bring some of those spare cartridges. And then they also talk about adding leg straps to the PFD. I rarely see people wear leg straps with their harnesses. I hear that they can be uncomfortable and things, but I think especially if you're on night watch, weather's really rough, it's probably just, you can get through a night watch shift with those on, so it's probably good to have them. As they say, when it's really rough and you hit the water, we just did a story recently, the guy lost his...
Yeah, came right off.
His PFD got ripped right off him, and it probably wouldn't have ripped off if he would have had the leg straps. They also talk about, if you don't have one already, install a fixed mount VHF and get a good quality masthead antenna, which greatly increases the radio's range, getting it all the way up there in the air. They also say the radio should have a registered MMSI number with your boat's registration, not somebody else's, if you're buying used equipment, and the DSC calling feature that has a way of inputting the GPS information. And if anybody's not familiar with DSC, it's essentially a button on the radio that you push in the event of emergency, and it automatically sends out your boat information, your MSSI, your GPS coordinates, all of that automatically. So really handy to have when you're in a big hurry and the boat's sinking quick and you just need to push something to get that message out there. And then also, you want to have a similarly equipped handheld VHF radio to put in your ditch kit or your dinghy. And I've read some of the stories. I think it was John Harries that does the Attainable Adventure Cruising site that he recommends having all of this on your PFD and tether. A signaling device like an LED, a way of attaching the VHF right to your vest. And
your own personal charm bracelet.
Yeah. You got all this stuff. You probably sink faster. I don't know. But, and then the EPIRBs. They talk about definitely have an EPIRB on the boat and have it registered. We talked about testing them. But then they have the personal locator beacons now. And that's another thing that you want to have it attached to your vest, of course. But then they have these new ones that have AIS technology in them, that if you fall off the boat, and I didn't know it did this, but I just read this recently, the latest technology even sends out a DSC signal, which you can use DSC signaling to call a specific boat. So if you're in an anchorage with a bunch of friends and you don't want everybody else to hear your VHF conversation, I believe you can actually signal, if you know their MSSI information or DSC information, you can actually call them like calling on a cell phone over your VHF radio, and only they can hear it. It's almost like an encrypted communication between you. So if you're wearing one of these man overboard beacons that has it's essentially a mini EPIRB, so it's going to send out a satellite signal, but it's also going to send out a DSC signal. So if somebody's sleeping on the boat, the radio will go off like it's ringing, and they'll know that you're no longer on the boat, you're in the water.
That's neat.
And then it has AIS in it, which if they wake up and they get up in the cockpit, they can see on the plotter on the boat
where you're located.
And they say the fastest people that are ever going to find you is the boat you just fell off of. So so that's what makes sense. And then, they say at last but not least, have something to signal people with. So a good signaling mirror, those are easy to attach to your vest, but then they have these new high-intensity LED strobes that are getting fairly reasonable. They recommend having those. So attach all that stuff to your vest, and you'll barely be able to walk around the boat, but you will be safe. Never can be too safe. Okay, our next story. Brandy loves these. Another disaster at sea story. Seems like I've got to include at least one or two of these in every sailing news. But this one just caught my eye as kind of a different take on things. This Jean Sturrock of Lyon, France, he's 65 years old, and his crewmate Kyle Castellan, a 20-year-old from Cape Town, were on a passage from the Maldives, and the yacht was on autopilot. It was a large catamaran. Looked like it was about a 40 or 50 foot catamaran. They don't put that in the article. But the yacht was on autopilot, and they were making about 12 to 13 knots in rough seas, and both men were down below when all of a sudden they felt a large bang, and the yacht just kind of came to a quick stop and then swung hard to port. And they rushed up on deck, and Kyle saw a whale on their port side. And immediately, water was flooding into the hull through a 28-inch hole in one of the hulls. And so they knew the boat was going to capsize. The water was coming in that fast. And so they ran down below, and there was nothing they could really do to plug the hole or supply. So they went back up on top, and Kyle, the crew member, threw the life raft overboard and then dashed below to grab emergency supplies. They got the EPIR beacon, and they transmitted on the VHF real quick a mayday. And by the time they got back up on board, back up on deck, they looked out, and evidently the life raft was not attached to the boat.
I was just about to say, aren't you not supposed to toss the life raft until the boat is, like, at water level?
Yes,
going under.
You are. And but if you're in that situation and you're in panic mode and you haven't gone through the steps, and who knows what people are going to do. So anyway, he threw the thing out, and I guess it wasn't attached to the boat, because by the time they got back up, they realized it was over 200 meters away.
Oh my gosh.
And now their only chance was the tender that was on the boat. So they took the inflatable tender and they got in that, and then they tried to start the engine to the tender to go get the life raft, but the engine on the tender wouldn't
start.
It never starts when you need it. So they pushed away from the yacht because the yacht was moving so much, and it started to roll over, and eventually it capsized, and they switched the EPIRB on. And the wind was at 50 knots, and they're just getting battered. And so they got separated from the catamaran at that point. And the EPIRB goes out, so all the rescue operations, all these ships are out looking for them. And they eventually find the boat, because the boat's the biggest thing. And they found the boat because that's where the original signal came from. But for some reason, the ships were tracking where it started. They weren't tracking the EPIRB because they went right to the boat. They found that. And then they found the life raft.
Oh, gosh.
And nobody was in the life raft. So then the EPIRB people are saying, well, why aren't you following the EPIRB? The EPIRB's going down the coast. It's floating down the coast. So then they start chasing the EPIRB. And this one ship captain, he's following the EPIRB, and he can see that it's following a specific path. And then all of a sudden it curves off to the left or whatever, and he's trying to decide, should he keep going on the same path or turn? Well, he turns, and shortly after that, that's when they found the two crew members in their dinghy. But, you know, you look at it, and there's so many things that could have gone wrong here.
Could have or did.
Yeah, I should have said did go wrong. You know, they do say, you know, especially with a catamaran that doesn't sink, it's probably still would be floating out there because it captures so much air. You know, if you can avoid it, don't leave it. I mean, they should have left a rope tied to the catamaran until they knew that they had to cut it. It was going to drag them down or something. But I'm sure they, you know, like I said, panic. You can always say these things that, oh, they should have done this, they should have done that. But, you know, at least stay with the boat as much as you can. You know, stay right there, figure out a way to stay in that area. But I guess with that kind of winds and things, you're
going to
get blown away so fast. So they got flipped a couple times in the raft during the night. The waves were that big, and they lost all of their rations. I think they lost the EPIRB at one point.
So how long were they, like, drifting and away before somebody found them?
It looks like it was about 24 hours by the time they found them. And then the problem was getting them on board this big container ship, And so they got close enough to where they could swim over and grab the rope ladder to get up. And of course the 20-year-old scrambles right up the ladder, but this, you know, 65-year-old, he was just worn out by that point because they had been rowing all the way through the night trying to keep the boat pointed in the wave. So he's just worn out. And he, at one point, he said, you know, I just wanted to make sure the kid made it up. You know, I've had a good life, and I felt bad that I got this 20-year-old out there that could die. And so when he saw the kid go up the ladder, he said, honestly, I didn't think I would have the energy to go up. And he lost grip of the ladder and went back into the water, and they thought they were going to lose him, but they were able to get a rope around him and towed him back up on the ship. So, so great work by the rescuers, and you know, a happy story at the end. You know, sad that they lost their boat, but they survived. But
again, makes you always think about the things you need to prepare on safety wise, because you just don't.
Make sure your life raft is at least attached to the boat before you throw it over, and you know, lots of things can go wrong. So. And our last story is about another super yacht sailboat that has been launched and has been turned over to the owners from its designers. And this one was designed by Bill Tripp III and his yacht design team. And as opposed to the world's largest sailboat that we featured before that the Russian billionaire built that looks more like a cruise ship with just some masts stuck on top of it, this is designed to be an extremely high-performance boat. So it is an 85-meter, that's roughly 280 feet for all the non-metric people, boat, and it's called a Kehoe. And it is a beautiful boat. I mean, it is super sleek, and some of the statistics on this thing are amazing. So, for instance, just to tell you the magnitude of the project, the keel bulb alone weighs 200 tons, and it's attached to the end of a relatively narrow keel, which that's just a lot of stress on a small amount, but I'm sure they've worked out all these the engineering on this. And it, on top of it being a 200 ton bulb at the bottom of this keel, it is retractable. At the push of a button, it can go from a maximum depth of 38 feet pulled up to 17 feet at a push of a button. So it's still going to draw 17 feet no matter what, but it is huge. I mean, they talk about the amount of power to lift 200 tons. That's roughly 200 cars, 8 double-decker buses, fully loaded, that you got to pull up and down the height of a two-story building. It says you would need 40 V-22 Osprey helicopters to lift that much weight.
Oh my gosh.
So it's amazing. And then the mass, it has dual mass. They're 300-foot tall carbon mass.
Holy crap.
They're just a few feet shorter than the Statue of Liberty. So that's acres of sail area, horsepower. Acres, not feet, acres. That's just amazing.
How many people would that take to maneuver? I guess it's very high tech.
Yeah, so they got hydraulics and all kinds of stuff, but I mean you're not going to sail it with two people. I mean, it's a huge boat, but really high performance. Somebody built this, wanted a boat that's going to sail really cool. I read another article on it that you get that big and you almost wonder if you standing at the wheel if it will feel like you're sailing a sailboat because it's so big. Well, they put these some kind of hydraulic sensors on the rudders so that the steering wheel feels like you're steering a 40-foot boat instead of a 208-foot boat. It gives you the same feel as you would on a 40-foot boat. Mm. They did all this high-tech stuff. So, you know, somebody's got a lot of money and they put it out there, but it's really cool to see some of the things that they develop.
I wonder on if on the screens that they're looking at to make them feel like they're driving that 40-foot boat, if the screen has a little mini boat on it.
Yeah, they have all the same stuff that you have on a small boat, but it's actually 108 feet shorter than the world's largest sailing yacht that the Russian billionaire built, but it would probably be able to sail across the Atlantic three times in the speed.
Does it say how fast it?
It didn't give any of those speeds. I don't know if they've taken it through all the tests to see how fast it. But I'm sure it'll do, you know, 20 knots under sail. It's just a matter of, you know, just how much fun it is. So pretty cool though. So that is it for the sailing news, and up next is our product of the week. We'll be right back. So now we're going to cover our product of the week, and I just keep going back to things that we use on our boat. I see other products featured that I think are interesting, but I'd rather cover things that we actually use on our boat. And I've really found these to be very helpful, and they're called bumper buddies. And essentially what they are is just covers for your fenders, but I'd found these years ago, and I think they really dress up the boat. Originally, you have these white fenders and they get all scuffed up and they look bad, but they also can get kind of gritty and scrape the side of your boat. So these cloth, they're kind of nylon covers that just stretch over elastic over your fenders. I think it makes the overall boat look fancier. We keep our fenders tied up on our lifelines and they match the boat, because they're black covers. And
yep, we went from blue to black, actually.
Yeah, so they look nice. And so these come in three sizes. They model them after the Taylor, three different sizes of Taylor, small, medium, and large Taylor fenders. And so you can get them different sizes. I think we have the mediums, and they're $16 with like $3 shipping on Amazon. And I think the large are $17 or $18, so the small are probably $13. So they're really reasonable. And they come in a bunch of different colors. You can get them in black, green, pink, purple, red, royal blue, yellow, and zebra.
You can get pink?
And zebra.
Wow. I say we get one pink, one zebra, and one black.
I'm not getting zebra fender covers for my boat. Our boat.
What if they just happen to appear?
Then I'm in trouble. I don't have a choice. But I guess you could get them to match every bikini color that you have.
Exactly.
So that's the product of the week. We found them to be very helpful, and they've really kept well. I mean, even getting salt on them and everything else, they still look great. And
yeah, they rinse off.
We're getting lots of good use out of them. So I'll put the links to those in the show notes and also in our Amazon store. And as always, check out the Amazon store or anything you're going to buy on Amazon. Go to thesailingroad.com/Amazon or look in the menu on thesailingroad.com and you'll see all our Amazon links for both the store and just the general link to go in and buy anything on Amazon. This makes a big difference in supporting the podcast, and we really appreciate everybody that's been going out and buying things there. And then also, as we always mention, please help support the podcast by telling your sailing friends about it. Tell them about a specific show that you like. If you know somebody that likes building boats, tell them about the episode we just did on building the Warham. I'm sure they would enjoy listening to it and hearing Neil's adventures on doing all of that. And as I mentioned before, we've also set up a donation link for a one-time donation in addition to our Patreon link. So you can find all that in the show notes on both the one-time and the Patreon donation links. Really help support the show. And that's about it for this week. So we'd love to hear from you. Please write to us. We love hearing from the listeners. You can email us at crew@thesailingroad.com. Give us any ideas you have about the show, things you like, things you don't like. Tell us what you'd like to hear more about. And that's it for this week. So thanks for listening. We really appreciate all their support, and we hope to see you on the water soon.
See you soon, guys.